Welcome to the Best Science Medicine Podcast, BS without the BS.
Hi, everyone, and welcome to the 462nd episode of the Best Science Medicine Podcast. My name is James McCormack, and I'm a professor with the Faculty of Pharmaceutical Sciences at the University of British Columbia.
I'm Mike Gallen. I'm a family doctor and the director of practice support at the College of Family Physicians of Canada, as well as a professor at the University of Alberta. Now, today we have a special guest because we had thought our guest had been on before, but he informed us that we have neglected him sorely and we needed to bring him on. He's a bit of an expert in family medicine on research, and also one of his areas is hypertension. So we wanted to fill in a few blanks around sprint and maybe later some stuff around timing of dosing and some other issues.
And targets and all that sort of stuff.
Yeah. Scott Garrison, can you please introduce yourself and try not to use any swear words?
I'm Scott Garrison. I am a family doc and an associate professor here at the U of A as for about 7 years now, joining what's considered the peer team now.
And Scott does right. Scott really does the real research in the group.
It's true, but it hurts when you say
it.
I know.
But and we'll talk a lot more about that at the end of the podcast. But today's Scott asked us if he could come on and talk about some of the issues around blood pressure measurements and targets and what numbers to get to, and it is exceedingly nuanced because when I started practice, 160 systolic, there's nothing wrong with that. But now we're down to, there's a big debate about, do you get them down to 140? Do you get them down to 120? And that is not a black and white answer. It's not a black and white answer to that question. And there's so many nuances, and we want to sort of work our way through that. And Scott, you're going to help us with that.
Yeah. So there's one particular study that you say prompted all this, which just came out over the last month. That relates to sprint. And what I'm going to do is I'm going to end with that study, which I think has two really impactful clinical pearls in it. But I'd like to sort of wind my way there with some context of some interesting studies that have come up in recent years in doing what Mike would, I think, call telling a good story in getting there.
Yeah, and that would be perfect. And the reason we're talking about sprint is that sprint is the trial that people are using to suggest that instead of 140, we should be going to 120.
And it's important to note, and I'm sure Scott will make reference to this, it is not the only trial that has looked at lower targets. It's the only one, at least that I'm aware of, that showed an impressive is in quotations, reduction in cardiovascular events. So some find it very impressive. Others find it, a potentially important impact, but not impressive. Anyway, it's in that range. And Scott's going to fill us in, I think, on some of the background information that we need to further interpret this.
Yeah. And so I think it begins with some of the observational data that if you're old enough, as I am, that you would have seen in the early part of your practice that people were talking about the J curve for hypertension. At that point, it was diastolic hypertension that they were talking about with sort of a sweet spot around 70 millimeters of mercury, with mortality rising as you went to blood pressure numbers that are higher, but also rising as you went to blood pressure numbers that were lower. And sometimes that J curve would be found, sometimes it wouldn't be. But in more recent years, there have been a few high-impact publications looking at U-shaped mortality curves for systolic blood pressure. So in 2016, there's a Lancet article about the CLARIFY registry. So this is 22,000 patients with stable coronary artery disease who were treated for hypertension in 45 different countries. They measured blood pressure on all of those individuals using the technique where you have 5 minutes of rest before your blood pressure is measured. And they followed them over 5 years. And that registry reported a beautiful U-shaped curve with the lowest mortality at 130 millimeters of mercury. and as well a U-shaped curve for major adverse cardiovascular events, for MI, for heart failure. A year later in The Lancet, there's another article. This time they're meshing together a bunch of large blood pressure studies of patients who also had cardiovascular disease. And it showed the same thing. If you look at achieved blood pressure for patients in these studies, you get the same U-shaped mortality curve. And then in 2018, the BMJ had a paper, a different population. This was from the Chinese longitudinal healthy longevity study. And they had 4,600 some, what they called oldest old, which meant people who were over the age of 80, with the mean age being 92 years. Also measuring blood pressure with the 5 minutes of rest first, followed by two readings. But they followed them for 3 years. They controlled for frailty as best they could in their analysis. But again, they're showing this U-shaped mortality curve with a sweet spot of lowest mortality around 130 millimeters of mercury. So we all are rightfully skeptical of observational data. I think most people would probably believe that the increased mortality as you go above 130 millimeters of mercury is probably from increased cardiovascular risk. But the increase in mortality that's being observed as you have lower blood pressure numbers, it could be that a lower blood pressure is harmful, but it could also be that a lower pressure is simply a marker of somebody who is sicker or frailer, and that's why the association is what it is. That's particularly plausible as far as older adults go, because there's this great article in JAMA Internal Medicine in 2017 where they used the United Kingdom's electronic databases. They can link hospital data with primary care data. And they looked at people who had died over the age of 60, right? So 46,000 people who had died. And they looked at the blood pressure in the 20 years prior to their death. And what they were able to show is that in the last 15 years of your life, your blood pressure actually continually and steadily falls. So if you die in your 80s or your 90s, in the last 10 years of your life, your blood pressure falls by about 15 millimeters of mercury. So we often think about blood pressure just rising as people are getting older. That's actually not true.
Scott, is that the average blood pressure or just systolic or both? Or what is it?
That's systolic.
Right. Okay. Yeah. Because I know, you know, from all sorts of data from when we looked at this years ago, is that the what I used to say is that your diastolic, you know, will go up until you around roughly around age 60 and then drop off, versus systolic just continues to rise. And that was why we had the whole concept of isolated systolic hypertension. But you're suggesting that may not necessarily be the case.
Yeah, if you anchor this on the date of death,
right,
and then look backwards,
right,
you find this pretty consistent, very steady. It increases in the last year of life, which is no surprise because they're whatever carries people away might be contributing to lowering their blood pressure. But for about 15 years, you have this very steady decline, at least in the mean,
right,
of blood pressure for this group.
Yeah. And as you say, you know, we always like to take a balance of all the evidence. And so when we have cohort trials, it's not that we don't think cohort trials are useful or that RCTs are the gold standard. It all depends on the question that you're trying to answer. Sometimes, you can only answer a question with a cohort trial and all that sort of stuff. But when it comes to thresholds of, you know, for blood pressure treatment or measurements and all that sort of stuff, we literally have to take into account all of the evidence. There's RCT data, there's cohort, there's even just you know, how you measure blood pressure studies in small numbers of people that we have to take into account. So it, we really have to look at it all before we can come up with any marginally black and white suggestion.
Yeah, absolutely. And I'm only introducing it at this point just to show that there's a very plausible explanation that as you are getting closer to death, that you could be having lower blood pressure numbers as an explanation for that U-shaped curve. Although clinically, actually, I took a lot from that study in that it made me look a little harder at my patients who are in their 80s.
Right.
About, you know, do they actually need all the blood pressure medicine that, that they're on, or can some of that be backed off?
Yeah, no, for sure.
Yeah, we see that in practice, right, Scott? When, I mean, our patients are in their 60s and that kind of thing, we're generally increasing their medicines. And then when they're getting towards the end of life, you're looking at their blood pressures that were maybe a little bit hard to manage before, and they're 110 because they're, their pressures are going down and they're still on these hypertension agents. And it's often, this is one of the things we talk about de-prescribing, always consider the blood pressure medicines as patients get older, because their pressures, the ideal pressure for them is likely not 110, right? And it gives us, what's happened is they're treated as if they were 160, but that started to decline now. And so I've seen that in practice quite a bit where it's time to back off.
Yeah, absolutely. There's so much emphasis in as far as deprescribing on potentially inappropriate medications, but it's actually common medications that bring patients into emergency rooms. And mm-hmm. So looking at, you know, do we need to be as aggressive as we are with glucose lowering or blood pressure lowering, I think is...
Exactly.
Yeah. So...
But most importantly, Mike just texted me and reminded me that I think I said cohort trials when I meant cohort studies.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So there you go.
Yeah. A trial is an experiment.
Yes, I totally get, and I 1,000% agree with you.
It's in your language now.
It's in my language. In fact, I've been trying to, interesting, because I'm doing some other writing around some other stuff, and I've been very, very good at not doing that yet, but it still is in my brain. It's tough. Anyway, keep going, Scott.
Yeah, so there's this interesting association, you know, may or may not have some import for whether low blood pressures might or might not be harmful. And the only way you can really answer that is with a randomized trial, of which there are very few that get patients to achieve that kind of lower range of blood pressure. So there's really only a few that I know of. In 1997, there was a study called MDRD, which looked at people who had chronic kidney disease, not necessarily having hypertension. And they had an aggressive treatment arm, which got down to 122 over 76 for the blood pressure, compared to a less aggressive arm, which no treatment, I guess, arm, which was 130 over 81 for their blood pressure. And it essentially showed no difference in mortality or cardiovascular hospitalization, which is the other hard endpoint that they reported. And then the other trial that gets people to that lower range as far as blood pressure targets is ACCORD, which was published in 2010. That trial enrolled type 2 diabetics, 4,700 and so of them, followed them for 4.7 years. In the intensive treatment arm, they got down to 119.3 millimeters of mercury. And the usual care arm, less than 140 target, was 133 millimeters of mercury. And that, again, was a wash as far as mortality goes. It was essentially the same in both groups, and it didn't show any difference on its primary endpoint, which was a composite of cardiovascular death, MI, or stroke. So that was kind of the lay of the land as far as trials achieving those low-end blood pressures prior to SPRINT, which was published in 2015. So I'd be surprised if there's anybody listening to this that doesn't know about SPRINT. It enrolled over 9,000 hypertensives who were at increased cardiovascular risk for other reasons. It excluded diabetics because ACCORD had seemed to show that lower targets weren't any better for diabetics. And it randomized them to trying to achieve less than 120 versus less than 140, followed them for 3.26 years. They checked blood pressure monthly for the first 3 months, and then every 3 months at clinic visits, or study visits, I should say. And they reported achieving the low-end intensive group blood pressure of 121.4 millimeters of mercury systolic compared to 136.2 millimeters of mercury in the standard treatment group. And, of course, the study was stopped early. It reported that its primary outcome was reduced by 25%, which was the first occurrence of cardiovascular death or MI, stroke, or heart failure. And it also showed some significance for some secondary outcomes, 38% reduction in heart failure events, 43% reduction in cardiovascular death, and a 27% reduction in all-cause death. So,
and it's important to put those in, like, those are all relative numbers. And so when you actually look at the absolute numbers for that primary outcome, you're looking at pretty much about a 1.5% absolute reduction. So from about 6.8 down to 5.2. So that's the benefit that was seen, is about a 1.5% absolute reduction over the time period of the trial, you know, which is, you know, 3 years.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah.
But this sent shockwaves through the hypertension guideline world, right? Like it changed those guidelines quite strongly. So I think going over it again and reminding ourselves, because I said at the beginning the impressive results, and that's because many people talked about them as impressive. When you look at them in a in the absolute benefit range, it's not quite as dramatic. So it's helpful to go over them. But I think, Scott, you're going to add in some nuance that happened in these trials that was lost in the original interpretation.
But I think just before we do that, but because those are the benefits that they saw, but the what is often not mentioned is what was seen as harm. There was about a very similar increase in acute kidney injury or acute renal failure.
James, I feel like this is the point where I plug my ears and go, la, 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 la.
Yeah.
When you're going to talk about arms.
Yeah. But it, you know, it's, and more people had electrolyte abnormalities. More people had hypertension, again, 1-2%. And
hypotension. Yeah.
Yeah. And so it, that's just the content. That's all I have. You can stop saying la, 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 because that's now I'm done. But it's just important that context has to be there.
Yes,
but now the nuance is, let's even assume it is nothing but benefit. There are still a lot of really important nuances, right?
Yeah, and I'll get to some of those. But as Mike said, like, you know, this has totally worked its way into changing guidelines by people extrapolating from SPRINT to other populations. And it also really kind of polarized, I think, a lot of the medical community, with some people who felt, you know, most clinical trials enroll healthier than typical people. You know, if I'm applying this to, you know, frailer people, lower diastolic pressures, more comorbidities, a whole bunch more medications that now I'm adding extra antihypertensive on top of, like, you know, will the harms be worse? So, yeah, so there's lots of people that, you know, rightfully had some skepticism about how much we could generalize this trial.
But and so, in the context of that, Scott, I'll just say that, you know, if you're someone who believes in hypertension, you're on one of these guideline committees because you're passionate about hypertension, you often come in with a belief system that is the higher your blood pressure, the worse you are. And it's that kind of the way we look at everything, whether it's lipids, sugars, whatever, we have to get them down, 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 down. And so then this trial, these other things you mentioned come out and they don't agree with that belief. So I kind of want to ignore them. But as Paul Simon says, we hear what we want to hear and we disregard the rest. So when this study comes out, we're like, wow, this says exactly what I want to believe. So yeah, we change our guidelines. And it's actually, you know, as one of my friends always says, the facts, well, interesting, are irrelevant. Our background, our beliefs influence so strongly how we look at this research and then how we interpret it to apply it to guidelines.
And the other caveat is, even assuming that it is actually true, the results are correct, you should get down to 120, 98.5% of people get no benefit over that 3-year period. Yeah. And I know I'm being just a negative person. So I'm saying that before you say it, Mike.
No. Yeah. No.
So it's so boy, it had better not cost much more, better not hurt people, better not cause inconvenience and worry and all that sort of stuff, if that's what we're talking about. But there's even more nuances to that, and it's really around the measurement, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and so good segue from that. So there were a bunch of different concerns that people had, and about a little more than a year after Sprint was published, one of those main concerns seemed to settle on something that had not been in the initial Sprint publication nor in the protocol or the supplementary information. I'm not sure how it got to be known, but there was concern that many of the clinics that were participating in Sprint were performing blood pressure assessment with the patients being completely unattended. So let me explain what that means. So in a typical blood pressure trial, so the patient comes into the exam room, they have 5 minutes of quiet rest. The nurse may or may not be with them in the room at that time. But if the nurse did leave the room, they come back into the room 5 minutes later and they start the ambulatory blood pressure machine going and either leave for the last two of the readings, having been there for the first to make sure it's working, or they might stay there for the whole thing. And then they average those three readings. So what happened in Sprint was that all of the clinics were educated on how to program the Omron 907XL ambulatory blood pressure, automated blood pressure machine, which they had in the clinic. And it was programmable so that the machine could, on its own, come on and start recording blood pressure readings so that you could greet the patient, bring them into the room, put the cuff onto their arm and set it up so that it would do its own thing, leave the room. And then 5 minutes into that quiet rest, the machine would come on, do a reading, and then do another two readings 1 minute apart after that. So the concern was that no one had ever done that before. There always had been a human present when blood pressure readings were being taken or at least initiated, and that would make the numbers appear lower than they would have been measured in a more conventional technique. And there was a Sprint ambulatory blood pressure sub-study, which was published, and it showed that the daytime ambulatory blood pressure was indeed about 6.8 millimeters of mercury higher than the office readings, trial readings from Sprint. There were a bunch of people who then tried to do some validation studies on that technique, comparing completely unattended blood pressure readings with that kind of an automated cuff to ambulatory blood pressure. And again, they find that there's about a 7 millimeter mercury difference, whereas traditionally you would think that daytime ambulatory blood pressure is pretty close to what you'd get with an automated office device and good technique. So this prompted the Sprint team to come out with another publication in 2018, where they surveyed 38 out of the 102 sites. I'm not sure how they picked those 38. Probably convenience for people that they knew or were able to interact with, to find out what did they do. Did they use the ability to have the machine do everything, or were people present? And so they found that 47%, so roughly half the time, the measurements were done with no human presence for any part of it. Compared to about 20% of them, they were alone during the rest period. 6.6% were alone just when the blood pressure repeated measurements were being taken. And 26% of them were never alone at any point in that clinic visit. With what they said was the important point, they were showing that regardless of which group you were looking at, always alone or never alone, it made no difference to the blood pressure readings that were reported. So they were refuting that that made any difference at all. So this brings us to the study that just came out last month in JAMA Internal Medicine, which is a comparison between the study trial blood pressure readings in Sprint and routine clinic blood pressure readings for the same patients in their primary care provider's office. So what this group did was they were able to link the electronic medical records at 49 of the 102 Sprint sites. So there would be 3,074 Sprint participants that this would apply to, which is about a third of the Sprint population. And they looked at the blood pressure readings in the primary care provider's office during the period from the six-month study visit, at which point you'd think that they were sort of stabilized on their regimen, up until trial completion. So these patients were 80.7% male, because 25 of the 49 sites that they were able to access were Veterans Affairs sites. And they were 68.5 years on average, years of age. And of all the ones that they reached out to, only about 64% were eligible. And by eligible, I mean to contribute to this analysis, you needed to have at least three blood pressure readings in the primary care provider's office that were eligible, and you had to have at least three Sprint trial readings that were eligible. They didn't count blood pressure readings if it was on the same day as you had a hospitalization or an emergency visit. They also excluded identical blood pressure readings between the trial and the clinic if they were within 3 days of each other. And the reason they did that was that occasionally the trial blood pressure reading was entered into the patient's clinical chart. So they wanted to make sure that those were not confounding anything. And if you had multiple blood pressures which were taken on the same day, they just averaged them to create one reading for that same day. They had a median of 17 blood pressure readings from the family physician's EMR and a median of 16 Sprint readings for each patient. And they didn't really know what technique the primary care provider's office was using. They stated in it, based on their knowledge of these clinics, that they expected most of these would be automated office blood pressure, but they really didn't know that. It could have been that they had used a wall-mounted, you know, sphygmomanometer. But certainly, it was more likely to have some of the imperfections in how all of us often take blood pressure, like, you know, the patient might have been talking, their arm might not have been supported, they may not have had 5 minutes of rest before.
So they were real life. So which is exactly what almost, because I doubt that you guys have seen patients who are in sprint. You know, you see the real life people in it. So that's sort of the importance of the study, is that it's looking at the real ways we measure blood pressures.
Absolutely. And I think Canadian primary care measurement and visits probably track reasonably closely to what I assume are largely American primary care visits here. I know there are differences, but I think it's reasonable to be able to generalize, I think, to our primary care offices. And they found that there was a difference, that the intensive group blood pressure, when measured with in the trial, was 7.3 millimeters of mercury lower than in the primary care office. And for the standard treatment group, it was 4.6 millimeters of mercury lower. Now, the fact that those two numbers are different, it's actually consistent with one of those validating studies that was done that also reported that the discrepancy was larger when you were measuring it on somebody whose pressures were lower. So that part doesn't concern me. But this is leading me to what I think are the two really important take-home messages in this. And both of those 2 points stem from what the achieved blood pressure actually was when measured in a primary care office. In the sprint intensive treatment arm, the blood pressure was 128.2 millimeters of mercury. So what I would suggest is that if you in your office were seeing patients in the intensive treatment group in sprint, you would be measuring blood pressures of around 128 millimeters of mercury. In my eyes, sprint is not evidence for achieving less than 120 in our patients, because what they achieved was primary care office blood pressures of 128.3. Do you want me to go on to the second pearl?
Okay, we actually don't know if 120 would have been better, but that's irrelevant. What you're saying is that, you know, really, if the guidelines, they probably shouldn't say 120, because it's not the real blood pressure. It's closer to 130, and I think, you know, people have said that over the years, but this trial gives even more clear evidence of why, you know, that 120 is a bit. It's not a real blood pressure, so to speak. It's a real in that, maybe in the clinical trial context, but it's not in real world. Mike, I don't know if you want to say anything.
So this is a common problem in clinical trial enrollment and our interpretation. So let's take diabetes, for example. In Canada, the guidelines recommend that you start patients on statins at the age of 40 if they're diabetic. And they base that on clinical trials, which set an enrollment criteria of if you're over 40 and diabetic, you can join this trial. Unfortunately, the people who were in the trial were in the ages of around 60. That was the average age, and very, very few patients in their 40s. And so applying it to people in their 40s doesn't actually reflect what the trial did. It reflects what the trial wanted to do. So to my mind, you have to calculate risk and then offer patient statins as a discussion. And this is true of all sorts of things, managing INRs, when it's too high, you name it. We what we actually intend to enroll and who we enroll is different, and that requires nuance in the interpretation of the results for clinical practice.
Not only nuance, and you did mention it, and then do a shared decision, because not everyone, again, if Sprint was just a 1.5% benefit, maybe not everyone would be thrilled with that. So it's very, and it's the biggest, it's why we write our own guidelines. It's the problem with guidelines is that they, even though they're thousands and thousands of words, they rarely address these really important practical issues.
Yeah. Yeah. Okay, so, Scott, what's point number two?
So point number two comes from the achieved blood pressure in the standard treatment arm, which was 139.3 millimeters of mercury. So that's almost 140 millimeters of mercury. If you happened to have a symmetric distribution of blood pressures, that would suggest that almost half of the people were actually having blood pressures which were over 140. So the question is, why is it so high? And I think the answer is that this wasn't actually less than 140 millimeters of mercury that was the standard treatment. So if you, in your practice, are shooting for less than 140 millimeters of mercury, you put some patients on medication. Sometimes you don't get a very good response. Sometimes you do get a really good response to a particular drug. And that patient might be 120. That might be in the 120s with their blood pressure. And if they are, you would say, great, let's go with that if the patient feels well. But in Sprint, that wasn't allowed. So Sprint was not less than 140. Sprint was 135 to 140. If you, on a single visit in the standard group, had a blood pressure which was less than 130 on that visit, the prescriber needed to either stop a med or reduce the dose of a med. If you were in the 130 to 135 range on two visits, then you needed to stop a med or reduce a dose. And that penalizes responders. And in fact, in the supplementary information, I don't know exactly how many people would have been stopped, but 11.3% of patients in the standard arm were on no blood pressure medication. And it's also problematic that you're trying to get patients into this really narrow range, 135 to 140. If you think about what you'd have to do to achieve it, you would probably have to be stopping, starting, adjusting medications maybe fairly often. I wasn't able to find anything that talked about how often, but medication changes itself are probably problematic. And at least in my mind, it really raises the question about, is this actually the standard of care? Because if it doesn't mirror the alternative, the intensive group might actually look better just because it was being compared to something that was inferior. Which I think, if you're not allowing people with the better responses to stand, it potentially is.
And I think it brings into the whole problem of even how we measure blood pressures, because I can, maybe in a trial you can get that, but in an individual to try to titrate to a 140 or 135 to 140, there's too much variability or variation in blood pressure measurements. I mean, you know, you say you got a good response because they got down to 120. That just because they might be at 120 for a number of reasons. I mean, there's a huge amount of biologic variation in blood pressure measurements. So, you know, I think the bottom line, Scott, is what you're saying is that, you know, this trial did not answer the question of 140 versus 120. It It might have been the trial design, but it sounds more like to me that, you know, if you are going to go to try to get lower, you know, we're really talking 130. It's not the 120s that people are that is being written in the guidelines, and I think a lot of people are already doing that somewhat, probably out of concerns of safety. But isn't that kind of what people are doing, even though it does say in the guidelines to go to 120?
Yeah, that's my gut feeling, and that tends to be what I do. I'm often trying to get patients around 130.
Mm-hmm. And Mike, I'm sure that's probably what you're doing now, eh?
Yeah, if I do offer a lower target, and I don't talk about it with everybody, but when I do, it's usually around 130 that we're targeting. Mm-hmm. I haven't had success with 120. I did when Sprint first came out. I'm an early adopter, so I tried that kind of thing. I didn't have great response. Mm-hmm. And it's for some of the reasons Scott went over too. It's there's a lot of nuance to these studies. This one, you know, it was well done to answer to support a belief. And there's nothing wrong with that. But we have to put it into practice, and then we have to put some of these caveats on it. And I think for me personally, the biggest one is I think it was important the way the control arm was manipulated. But I also, and when I say manipulated, I don't mean that there was some
deception,
evil conspiring behind it. I'm just saying how they managed to get the blood pressure just right.
I'm pretty sure I looked at the name. I think one of the authors was a warlord.
Yeah,
I'm not. Yeah. Please don't repeat that.
I've heard from people that this could be the case. Yeah, people are saying.
Yeah.
Anyway, and the other one, I think one of the biggest things to take home though is people were not at 120; they were optimized as far as measuring. So the measurements were as low as they could possibly be, and it was still only 128. So it's just a wake up call for our offices that targeting when this trial did not advocate for 120, to getting patients below 120.
And I think the good thing about what you've gone through, Scott, is you're sort of demonstrating that it's not just our sort of opinion. What people are trying to do is bring here's other evidence to suggest why it's not black and white 120. And I think so you can still be evidence based and say 130. You know, that's the, you know, especially once you start looking at the nuances of these clinical trials and everything. So I think it's really, and again, the entire concept requires that sort of thoughtful discussion, putting in, you know, using risk calculators, talking about the potential benefits, telling people to worry about the side effects, not worry about the side effects, but to make sure they're not having them. Because I would suggest anybody who does not tolerate blood pressure medications probably should not be on them, especially if you're looking at a 1%, 2% benefit. It gets very, very tricky. And so, you know, this just all of this data just reemphasizes the importance of the sort of the methodology or the approach that we are suggesting in clinical practice. So now I know, Scott, you wanted to anything else you wanted to add about this point? And I know you wanted to add some stuff about some really cool research stuff that you're doing.
Nothing more about Sprint stuff.
So okay. Why don't you tell everyone about what you're doing, because you're trying to answer a really important question as well.
Yeah. So it's not just what I'm doing. So the whole peer team, including you guys, have been involved in organizing a large randomized trial over the last 3+ years. So your listeners might know about the MAPEC study, which was published in 2010. This was a Spanish study that had randomized patients with hypertension to take their blood pressure pills either in the morning, as is convention, or at bedtime, and it reported a 61% reduction in a composite of death and a bunch of cardiovascular outcomes. And it never changed practice. at that point, it largely because it seemed too good to be true. You know, the next best thing we have would be probably a statin, which might have given you a 35% reduction. It was also not published in a mainstream journal. And your listeners might also know that there was another study called Hygieia, which was published about a year ago, maybe a little less than a year ago, in European Heart Journal, reporting essentially the same thing. So that study is actually by the exact same principal investigator. So it isn't actually independent confirmation. And there are some difficulties with the reporting of the trial, which the journal is currently sort of looking into. So there is this question, I think, which remains. And there's two independent groups around the world which are trying to reproduce this study. One of them is called the Time Trial. That's being done in the UK. They'll probably be reporting their results next year. And the other one is us. We're running a trial called BedMed, and it does exactly the same thing. It recruits patients who have hypertension, and it randomizes them to take their blood pressure meds, as many as is convenient and easy to switch, to the allocated time, either morning or bedtime. So far, we've randomized, I think it's roughly 2,700 patients. We have about 360 family physicians, which have been recruiting patients in five different provinces, or at least those 360 are from four provinces. They're from Alberta, from BC, from Saskatchewan, and Manitoba. The fifth province, which is Ontario, we're hoping to be starting recruiting in January. And we have about 8 months left to go for the recruiting, and we're still going to really not know the answer. We won't be doing our final analysis until the end of 2022. But we're looking, we use administrative claims data to find out, you know, is there a difference in mortality, strokes, heart attacks, other outcomes like nursing home admission. We're also looking very closely at adverse effects, probably more than any other group, the ones that we'll be able to report on whether there are negative things that come from doing this. But the key thing I would like to let the family docs out there know is that this is a completely family physician-led and facilitated trial. We would really like to have another probably 1,000 patients enrolled in the study to have the power that we need. It's the largest randomized trial, non-industry randomized trial ever done in Canada. And we very much need you to consider participating if you think that it's something you might be interested in. You know, we really do have it quite dialed down now about how to participate in the trial. I think it really can be done with very little impact on the workflow in the practice. The people that are organizing this are all family physicians, so we totally understand how that workflow goes. And if you might be interested, you can see more on our website, which is pragmatictrials.ca. But more importantly, if you think you might be interested in participating, or if you just want more information, if you email us at pragmatictrials@ualberta.ca, then we can either get you set up to participate or to give you that information that might help you decide. If you're in a different province other than those five, feel free to still email us. We'll keep you on the list. And if in the future, our next study is in your province, we can reach out to let you know, and then you can decide then if you do want to participate with us.
Scott, sure. We'll put all those links in the show notes so people can contact you.
Yeah, which is awesome.
Yeah.
And this isn't just a one-off trial. You know, if we ever want to be taken seriously as the quarterbacks of our patients' care, we have to start providing some of the evidence on what is best care. And so we intend to be doing this with other trials to follow on. So if you think you'd like to be part of it, reach out to us and we'll keep you on the list to let you know when opportunities arise.
Very cool. So we've got some hopefully useful practice tips of what to do when it comes to blood pressure. And as you said, Scott, you're sort of doing a study to look answer another really important question. So, Mike, anything you want to add?
No, that sounds good. Just encourage people to consider joining if they can.
There's absolutely
always room for more. I think Scott hit the nail on the head. We need to take charge of our own research in our practices, and that is going to help us have more clout at the table and also get better answers for writing guidelines that are influential to our practice.
No, exactly. So I think we'll just leave it at that then. So thanks as always for listening.
Talk to you later.
Thanks.